He has it! And what a way to get it! A maiden Test Match 100 for a dream entertainer. You little beauty! What a way to bring it up. He only leant on that. It's gone straight over the ropes into the crowd. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Managing Violence Podcast, the internet's leading free resource on violence prevention, threat assessment, personal security and self-protection, brought to you by R2S Violence Prevention. We are hashtag for the protectors. I'm your host, Joe Saunders. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode 100. It is the centenary of the Managing Violence Podcast. Not quite 100 years, but 100 episodes. And many thanks to Andrew Simons for his test century that provided the audio for the lead into this event. And thank you also to the English cricket team for always being fantastic losers in an Ashes series to give me that audio snippet. Now, obviously, the 100th episode of any podcast is a really big deal, and it's as you'd imagine, not something that I've previously done before. I've never had a podcast that's made it to 100 episodes, so I was very conflicted as to what to do with this episode, and those that are part of the Managing Violence Tribe on Facebook, which I encourage you all to join, will know that I put things out to a vote. I suggested some different guests that we might have and some repeat guests and floated some ideas, some big names that might come in and do the 100th episode. Also floated the idea of having someone, having myself do a bit of a best of episode. We bounced around a few different things, and there's some pretty good feedback, some very considered feedback about which sort of guest would be appropriate, or indeed that whether it should be a Joe only episode with me reflecting upon the podcast, where it's been, where it's going, all those kinds of things. And at the end of the day, I decided that was the angle to go with. There was I wanted to be able to contribute something in my own right, to be able to reflect, to be able to thank you all for the support over 100 episodes, over 3 years of this podcast, and be able to really share some thoughts in long form with you. Now, I then bounced back and forth across some different ideas about how I would do that and what form the episode would take. And initially, I was thinking about doing a real best of reflection, where I would go back through my favorite episodes and use snippets of those episodes and then give a bit of a debrief about what it meant to me and so on and so forth. But what I found as I started to do that was that I was a bit concerned that I was looking backwards instead of looking forward. And this has been an incredible journey for me, but I don't like spending a whole lot of time thinking backwards on where we've been, but rather where we're going. So I abandoned that episode mid-production to be able to focus on something different, something better, something that I think we're all going to get value from. So this episode, episode 100, is going to serve to a degree as me planting a flag. It's going to be a mission statement, a call to arms, a position statement, however you want to phrase it. I'm going to be outlining where I think our industry needs to go moving forward, and where I am hoping to take, well, certainly how I'm taking my own practice, but also where I would like others to go as well. And if you've been on this journey with me, if you've been an avid listener of the show, if you've listened to all 100 episodes, you probably are on the right, well, probably on the same page, rather, whether it's a right page or not is up for debate, but you're certainly probably on the same page as me in terms of the priorities when it comes to teaching people how to manage violence. So I've been giving a lot of thought to this, heading into the UK tour coming up in March, April of this year. I've been giving a lot of thought to my structure, to what I teach, how I teach it, how I can transmit that to people in a better format, not just to end users, but also to other instructors. And it's really given me a lot of time to evaluate the structures, the systems, the things that go into my practice of violence management And really the evolution that I've been on that's led me to this point. And this podcast, I think, will give me an opportunity to be able to share that with you all. So this is really out there for the practitioners. This is for the instructors, for the protectors, for those that influence others. This episode is really for you because it is a call to arms to start doing what we do better. Now, I'm not going to be arrogant enough to think that everybody who's listening to this show has listened to 100 episodes of this podcast previously. Certainly, if you include the bonus content and the YouTube content that's out there, I mean, we're talking 150 plus hours of content that is out there now. So you may not know a whole lot about me. You might know about some of my guests, and you've just popped in for those episodes. And if that's the case, then thank you for coming back to check out this one as well. But I will just quickly run through, my journey professionally in this space because it'll give some context to what I'm going to say next. So, like a lot of people, I started off in the martial arts as a child. I started training traditional martial arts at about the age of 4 years old, started off with Taekwondo, moved around a lot, picked up different martial arts every time we moved, and just developed some beginner-level skills in a lot of different places. Which was very useful later on, although frustrating as a child. And then when I was about 15, I discovered combat sport. I started training as a wrestler. Wrestling led me into judo because judo had a lot more competition outlet than wrestling did for me at the time as a teenager in Australia. So being able to compete in judo opened my eyes, and I switched my focus from traditional martial arts to pretty much pure combat sport for a number of years. And I really loved that combat sport training. It led to me practicing arts like Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and submission wrestling, as well as boxing, Muay Thai, and mixed martial arts, and pretty much every other form of grappling I could get my hands on. I absolutely love my grappling. So that was my evolution into combat sports. But when I was 18 years old, I took a job working in a nightclub as a bouncer, as a crowd controller, as a door supervisor, whatever the terminology is in your country. But I was also a psychology student at the University of Queensland. So I had a kind of an interesting perspective on what I was doing on the door. I had this martial arts and combat sports physical background. I had the beginnings of an understanding of psychology. And I also had, I guess, the martial arts side of me. And also I was 18 years old, right? I was misguided. I didn't really understand what I was doing. I didn't really understand what I was looking at. I wasn't a kid who'd grown up around violence. I'd been fortunate to have a fairly stable middle class upbringing. Other than the occasional bully experience, I really hadn't dealt with violence. It's certainly nothing I'm upset about. It's a great thing. This was my first real experience of people trying to hurt each other, or people really trying to do harm, or the unpredictable elements of violence. And that was an amazing learning curve for me at a young age to be able to professionally observe this. And I still remember the first couple of fights I had where it wasn't a sport fight, where there wasn't a referee, where there wasn't any understanding that we're not going to try and cause injury to each other. That in fact, that was the opposite. I was trying to protect somebody else. I was trying to protect the person I was fighting, but they were not trying to protect me. I was concerned about my use of force. I was concerned about what injuries I might do them while defending myself, but they were trying to stick a bottle in me. So with those sort of factors, it was a really big eye-opener. And that led to me looking into something else. I needed something else in terms of training to bridge the gap between what I had experienced, what I trained in, and what I was experiencing. And as luck would have it, I was an avid reader of Blitz Martial Arts magazine, which was Australia's largest martial arts magazine at the time. And they did an interview series or an article series with a guy named Richard Dimitri. Obviously, if you're a listener of the show, you might know Rich from his time with Senshido or his current work with Safe International and Study of Violence. But Rich was saying all the things in the articles that I was experiencing about how violence is dynamic and it's emotional and there's lots of variables and there's multiple attackers and there's weapons and there's environmental constraints and how often what we teach in traditional martial arts and in sporting martial arts or combat sports doesn't have an immediate correlation to reality. And so I was very intrigued by that. I decided to go along to some seminars that he was running. I attended some seminars with Rich on his first ever Australian trip. Had a great time. We've covered all this in length in the Rich Dimitri episode, so go back to there if you want more details. But struck up a friendship with Rich and kept studying. Rich gave me a reading list. I started reading books by people like Jeff Thompson, Rory Miller, Dan Millman, Mark McYoung, and really getting deep in the weeds in that early 2000s reality-based self-defense world. And got very, very, well, I guess converted would be the way to describe it. I still liked my combat sports. I was still practicing combat sports to a degree, but because I was now working and all those kinds of things, I wasn't training those at a high level. So I got very deep into the reality-based self-defense world, including scenario training and all those different bits and pieces that made up the reality-based world of that early time. If you were involved in the reality-based self-defense or Krav Maga or Blauer or Wagner or any of those people from that time, you know what I'm talking about. But the next big evolution for me after that was that I knew I wanted to teach this stuff professionally. I had really found my calling. I'd found what I love to do. I love to protect people, but I also love to teach people. And you combine those two things, and I love to teach people how to protect themselves. So that was the next big thing, is how do I get paid for this? And I, of course, the default response for most people in that position, and most of the people probably listening to this that are martial arts instructors, was, well, you open a dojo, right? You open a school, or you hire a hall, or you start teaching people. And I went down that path, but anyone who's been there and done that knows that that is really, really difficult to make a living. It's very, very hard to get those first students, especially if you're teaching something that people don't know. I was advertising reality-based self-defense in, 2009 in Australia, and no one knew what that was. They came in looking for something completely different to what I was offering, and I really didn't have the maturity to be able to bend what I was doing to what they needed. And therefore, I had a handful of very committed students, but it really wasn't financially viable. So I continued teaching there just one day a week, hiring a space to make that happen. But I knew I needed to do something else. I wanted to do this professionally. And I became aware that there were full-time instructors working for the health department, the state health department, teaching something called aggressive behavior management. So I started doing some digging to find out how you get one of these jobs, how you start teaching that material. And I end up working for the state health department first as in a security and fire protection role to get my feet into the industry, and then managed to get myself onto the instructor development course and spent 4 weeks full-time training to become an instructor in that healthcare program. And that was a massive learning curve for me, because while I had a pretty good understanding of the combative side, I had a pretty good understanding of the basic self-defense that was being taught. To be able to wrap my head around things like mental health conditions, acquired brain injury, dementia and geriatric health, all the different factors that lead to people becoming aggressive in hospitals and in nursing environments, and also the psychology of the people that we were training, who were not combative persons. They were not security guards. They were not police. They were nurses, carers, social workers, catering staff, wards people, cleaners, doctors. They were people that had never put hands on someone in anger in their lives, and the very idea of doing so was abhorrent to them. So that process of not only learning that material, but then going into the classroom as a 23, 24-year-old instructor who really, other than part of a psych degree and a bouncer, didn't have a whole lot of credibility with these people. So being able to teach that and develop myself as an instructor and build rapport and show that I was interested in learning from them was a massive learning curve as well, but absolutely pivotal in what would come next in my career. Now, after bouncing around for a little while in the state health department in that aggression management role, in an investigations role, in a risk assessment role, all around, centered around violence and safety, I'd gone as high as I could for my age. I was still in my mid-20s, and the jobs that were above where I was, no one was going to give me in my mid-20s. So I decided I would leave and go do something else, end up working in a position for a company called Asset College, training security guards, training bouncers, training bodyguards, training anyone involved in that security operations space, and more holistic training, but also incorporating the defensive tactics and the violence prevention material that I had already been teaching with the health department. So that was another interesting shift into more regulated training. But over the next 10 years, I've really spent most of my time consulting to different organizations, training people where I could, delivering webinars and seminars and workshops wherever I could, for all sorts of different organizations with different risks, different types of conflict and so on. Now, most of the time during that time, I was working in some sort of security protection or management role within different organizations and doing this on the side. Now, what happened about 3.5 years ago was that I got an opportunity to do it full-time for a company called Risk to Solution. Or as you'll know from the start of the show, we're sponsored by R2S Violence Prevention. And R2S Violence Prevention was the violence prevention practice that I was able to stand up internally for Risk to Solution. And that was another massive leap forward for me in my understanding, in my professional development, my personal development. Because for the first time, I was coming into major companies and government organizations, federal, state, and local government organizations, $100 million companies, and talking to them about their workplace violence risk and what they needed. And it was quite scary for me because, again, a lot of imposter syndrome creeping in here. I still saw myself as a martial artist, as a combat sport guy who had some idea of what real violence looks like, but I had no idea how to translate that into corporate speak. So what that meant for me was that I had to understand the principles of risk management. I had to start understanding where this fit within an organization's operations. Does it fit within safety? Does it fit within security? Does it fit within HR? Who do I need to talk to? How do I influence those people? What matters to those people? How do I translate what I do into their language so that we can understand this and make their staff safer? And that's been an amazing journey for me as well, which I won't say culminated, but it's peaked last year where I was named the 2021 Australian Outstanding Security Consultant of the Year, based purely on my work with workplace violence prevention and the standards and models that I've created in that space. So that has been, I guess, the snapshot of my journey to this point. And the reason I share that is because my evolution has led to the evolution of how I teach. Now, I started out, as I said, as a martial artist. The first things I taught were martial arts. That's it. Nothing else. Then I taught combat sport. Okay? And sometimes I blended the two together. Sometimes I would teach a traditional martial arts something and then a combat sport application for that, or a combat sport, something I saw in the UFC and then linked it back to a traditional technique. But it was still very physical. When I went into training in healthcare, suddenly I had to relearn everything from a different angle because I wasn't training athletes. I wasn't training people that even had base level coordination. I was training people that were, you know, a typical profile was mid 40s, slightly overweight, with at least one major injury that we had to navigate. So physical responses were not always going to be the best course of action for those students, and nor did they want that. They wanted to understand how they prevent stuff from happening in the first place. So that evolution led to me looking at, well, okay, how do I give people that when they don't have the physical skills or the physical ability to learn complicated techniques very quickly? And organizationally, there wasn't a massive appetite for being able to teach healthcare staff how to shred people and rip their faces off, because it's just not a good look on camera when a nurse does that to your grandpa. So that was an evolution for me as well. And it's led to me putting a lot of systems behind how I teach violence prevention and management. So that's the preamble, I guess, to this particular episode. Now, I've got three main points that I want to cover off as to what I see the future of this industry should be. And I hope I'm predicting how it will be, but I'm at least stating how I think it should be. And if you agree with me, I'd love to have you on the journey with me as we try to build this. The first point, kind of the very, very first thing that I think we need to do as an industry and as an industry of self-protection practitioners, and I deliberately use that term self-protection because usually when that term is used, it's used by people that kind of get it in a way. We're not just martial artists. We're not just combatives. We're not just self-defense in the classical terminology where someone grabs you by the lapel, you trap the hand, you roll the thumb and you do the wrist lock, and then you, like that, moving beyond that, right? Usually when people use the term self-protection, they're actually looking a little bit deeper, at least into situational awareness and profiling and all those bits and pieces. They might not go as far as I'd like them to go, but they usually understand. So when I say the self-protection industry, I'm talking about people like you and I who train people, who train others, whether it's on an ongoing basis in a classroom or class environment, or whether it's in a seminar once-off environment, but you train people for the express purpose of keeping them safe from violence. Okay? So you're not running cardio kickboxing classes, or if you are, that's a separate business offering. You might be running combat sports, but that's separate. But what we're talking about here is self-protection. So the first thing I would like to propose that we look at as an industry is actually redefining what we do and rebranding what we do. Because from my personal experience, I have used such a variety of terms to describe what I do when I'm trying to talk about it commercially. Self-defense being the obvious first one that a lot of people stick with still. As Mark McYoung mentioned in the interview I did with him, like, self-defense is a legal term. Okay? It's something you use to in a court of law to get yourself off an assault charge, right? That's what self-defense means. I was defending myself. But also self-defense does have the baggage of being reactive instead of proactive. Okay, what I want to do when I'm teaching people how to keep safe is to not put them in bad situations in the first place, not to know which move to pull off in a certain situation. So I lean away from self-defense. I've also called what I do combatives, right? Because combatives is a little bit less clunky than martial arts. It's a little bit more, it feels a little bit more practical. There's less mysticism involved. And I'm not talking about all martial arts are that way, but when people Google martial arts, they could be looking for all sorts of different things, which I might not have the skills, ability, or interest to teach. But when they Google combatives, it's a pretty good sign that they know what they're looking for, and I can provide them that. So I've used that terminology. I also used RBSD, or reality-based self-defense, for a long time, right? And RBSD is such a niche term that no one ever searches for it. So it kind of kills the commercial viability of that terminology. We still do use it within the industry, but it appears to be pretty much dead at this point. I don't see a whole lot of places that are still using it. It seems to have petered out in the last decade. So what I would suggest is that if our priority is keeping people safe from violence, why don't we just call what we do violence prevention and management? Now, I got this idea from the threat assessment community who use the terminology threat assessment and management, or TAM. And I think violence prevention and management really encompasses what we do. So VPAM, however, I'm sure someone will make a sexier version than that. But from now on, what I'm calling what I do is violence prevention and management, because that's all I'm trying to do. I'm trying to teach people how to prevent violence from happening in their lives and how to manage it when it does happen. That's it. Everything else falls within that. We don't have to have an identity crisis because we are marketing as self-defense and people want to come along and punch some pads and do some wrist grab escapes. We don't have to have that identity crisis anymore because we can say, well, that's not part of violence prevention and management. Not saying the punching pads is a bad idea, but it's a tiny part of what we do with violence prevention and management. We don't have to have that branding associated with it. So, for example, I know there's a number of Krav Maga clubs out there that still call what they do Krav Maga purely because that's what people search, right? Search engine optimization. But they've kind of deviated a long time ago from the Krav curriculum. So maybe that's an option for them as well. It also opens us up for looking to outside influences. If you are still living in that martial arts bubble where you only want to look at martial arts or combatives' defenses to situations or responses to situations, then perhaps you're missing out on a lot of really valuable information that you could be getting from other disciplines. Now, historically, I have found that there is a reluctance to embrace academics within the self-defense field because there's this idea that academics are detached from reality, they're talking theoretically, and therefore nothing they have to say is of value. Well, the reality is, as you go back through the back catalog of the Managing Violence podcast, I've had quite a few PhDs on, and most of them have got some sort of practical experience. They're not just academics, they're pracademics, right? But being able to bring in someone who has an understanding of how the brain works, someone who has an understanding of how stress response works, someone who has an understanding of how the legal system works, those people are incredibly valuable to the practice of violence prevention and management. And we should be embracing those people, not pushing them away because they don't have a black belt, not pushing them away because they're not really interested in showing up for the sweat sessions or the pressure test or the Shark Tank drill or whatever else you're going to run on Thursday. These people have a lot to add to our understanding of violence and how we train it. So I think by realigning and rebranding ourselves under the banner of violence prevention and management, we open the door to look at this more systematically more academically, but also more practically, to see what is out there that we could be adding to what we teach to make our students safer. Because our job now is not to create black belts. Our job now is not to get people to the next instructor level. Our job now is to make people safer. So what am I going to give them? It's going to help them prevent or manage violence. Full stop. It also gives us a lens to decide what to exclude from our training. So if I'm looking at my training curriculum and I am looking now through the lens, not as combatives, not as whatever my martial arts system is, but through the lens of violence prevention and management, I can then look at, okay, so how much time am I spending on preventing how much time am I looking at maybe the red flags in relationship violence? Okay, so when you meet someone new, they seem really lovely or they seem really nice, whether it's a romantic relationship or friendship or just someone trying to get close to your family, and you start looking at the red flags. How much time do I spend on that to identify predators that are trying to groom me or groom my family or get close or get into a position of trust versus how much time am I spending on knife defense? Now, you may be living in a place where it has a lot of knife crime and therefore knife defense might be a good thing to spend some time on. But for most of us, it's probably disproportionate to the actual threat. If I look at knife on knife, which I see a lot of combatives instructors like teaching, like offensive knife skills, I'll be completely honest. I hope I'm never ever in a situation where I have to offensively use a knife on somebody because one, it's going to be incredibly dangerous if I'm ever justified to do that. Two, it's going to be a pretty traumatic event that's probably going to leave a mark on me for life. Three, it's probably going to change the way I parent. It's probably going to change the way I have relationships moving forward as I manage the trauma of that situation. And four, there's 100% chance I'm going to end up going to court, right? There's 100% chance if I have to stab somebody to defend myself, I'm going to court. That's going to be expensive. It's going to be stressful. It's going to have career implications, right? So when we start teaching things like that, without consideration of what we're actually training people to do, that can be problematic. But also, if I'm looking at an overall curriculum of violence prevention and management, how much time should actually be dedicated to offensive knife work? I'm going to leave that open. I'm not going to tell you because it depends where you live, depends what your realities are, depends what your weapons laws are. But I'm going to venture that for most people, it's not very much at all. Okay, so it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of what should be taught for violence prevention and management. And for most people, they'll never train long enough to get to the part where they should have been learning offensive knife work. But I'm just going to leave that open for interpretation. And by the way, if you don't like what I'm saying, that's totally cool as well. This is just my journey, where I'm at, my reality, the people I've trained, the people I've talked to that have informed my view on that. So I think if we can reframe what we do as violence prevention and management as a committed field of study that is built for stated aims, it's built for purpose. It is not shoehorning the karate techniques that I really, really like and trying to find some bunkai that explains how this fits within a ATM mugging. Okay, that's not what we're doing anymore. We're not trying to adapt a military combative system that was built for a conscript army to train them in 6 weeks to be able to function on a battlefield and then trying to explain why it is perfect for a 70-year-old pensioner who is concerned about having their bag snatched when they go to withdraw their cash. Right, I'm not trying to do that. What I'm trying to do now is look at violence prevention and management strategies, what is going to be appropriate for my clientele to make them as safe as I possibly can. There is no obligation whatsoever for them to even break a sweat if I don't think that is going to be the appropriate response for that particular clientele. So that's the first thing. Let's redefine what we do. Scrap self-defense, scrap combative, scrap RBSD. You can still teach that stuff. You can still have combat sports classes. You can still have cardio classes. You can still have social classes. I still train all that stuff whenever I feel like it because I enjoy it, but it's not what I'm teaching. What I'm teaching is violence prevention and management. All right, part two. Another thing that I've been given a lot of thought to in recent times is this idea of actually looking at risk management strategies. And I started doing this obviously, when I joined a risk management consultancy, I had to really make sure I was fluent in risk management conversation, risk management language and terminology and the concepts that are involved in that. And at first, it was just kind of an academic exercise because I had to make sure that I knew what I was talking about. But as I started to unpack the accepted risk management principles, Over time, I've really started to embrace them as the foundation points for building a solid violence prevention and management practice. Now, I'm assuming that the vast majority of my listeners are not risk management practitioners, but I will quickly just outline that, risk management could be talking about financial risk, it could be talking about security risk, safety risk, fraud risk, like there's any type, there are hundreds of different types of risks that we might be applying. So the risk management standards are the ISO 31000 2018 standard, which is the International Standards Organization's risk management guidelines, spells out 8 different principles that should make up solid risk management. And I think we can apply these very, very well to our violence prevention and management practice, because what is violence prevention and management if not risk management? Okay, we should be looking at the risk that our clientele face and building systems to help them manage that risk. Where possible, we want to avoid the risk at all costs. Well, we want to eliminate the risk at all in all forms, but sometimes we're going to have to manage it in different ways. So if we can relook at violence prevention and management not as a physical activity, not as a hobby, but rather as a risk management practice, it just gives us a new lens to look at things. So walking through the 8 principles of risk management as specified, as spelled out in the ISO 31000 standard, the first one is integrated. Okay, and now when the ISO 31000 standard says that risk management should be integrated, it's talking about from a company point of view that good risk management practices should be integrated throughout the operations of the business, so that it shouldn't just be an individual function. Everyone has a role to play in risk management. Now, what I would the application I see for the concept of integration is that really personal safety, violence prevention and management, that should be integrated within our day-to-day life. It's not just, oh, I'm in a fight now. Now I need to draw upon that thing that I learned in class 2 years ago. It should be, where do I park my car? Or I'm going to park my car with facing out so that I've got the ability to get out quickly. Or I'm going to park where I have good visibility of the street that I'm on, because I know bad things happen on this street. It's not paranoia. It's just that what I have learned in my violence prevention and management classes or in the education that I've gone through has been integrated into my day-to-day life. It's no longer segmented. It's something that I can apply. So if you're teaching people at the moment, and I'm gonna throw these out there to you as a challenge for you to think about and to introspect on, if you are teaching people at the moment, is what you are teaching able to be integrated within their day-to-day life? And if not, how could you adapt it? How could you add to it? How could you reframe it so that it can be? So that's the first principle, integration. The second principle is that it should be structured and comprehensive. So risk management frameworks should be structured and comprehensive within organizations. I also think that our violence prevention and management practice should be structured and comprehensive. I should know what I need to teach, not just what I feel like teaching. I should know what the risks are that an individual student faces based upon their lifestyle, their occupation, their age, their injury history, any traumas they're dealing with, their family situations. Obviously, you know, the more information we have, the better we can do that. But I should have a structure of how I'm going to make each of these individuals safer, not just I feel like teaching a bit of grappling tonight, so therefore we're going to do half guard to back takes just because we haven't done that for a while, right? We need to be structured and we need to be comprehensive. So I've talked a lot in podcasts, both my podcast and when I've been interviewed in other podcasts, about some of the gaps in self-protection training. How many people are actually training verbal skills? Very, very few. Those that are training verbal skills, they often don't have a curriculum because they don't know how to teach it, right? And that's not anyone's fault. There hasn't been a lot of education how to teach that. It's one of the things that I'm looking forward to sharing when I go to the UK and start teaching these seminars in the new year or in this year. But our practices have to be structured and comprehensive. If we're not talking about situational awareness, if we're not talking about trauma management, if we're not talking about relationship management, if we're not talking about social violence and predatory violence, impromptu violence and intended violence, if we're not talking about elder abuse as much as we're talking about terrorism, then our systems are not comprehensive. Okay? Now, the weighting on those is going to be different depending on who you're training and what their exposures are and the realities of your student base and all those kinds of things, right? But structured and comprehensive is the second principle and absolutely applies to what we do. The third principle is customized. Okay? So our risk management approach should be customized. So our violence prevention and management approach should be customized. this, I'm sure I'm beating a dead horse at this point, but if you're training a 70-year-old grandmother the same way you're training a 24-year-old bouncer, then you are absolutely missing the point. Right? You are now training based upon your own limitations, not based upon what the student needs. And it's cool to recognize your limitations and go, I don't know what to teach that person, but then tell them that. Tell them that you don't have the skills and knowledge that they need to stay safe, or that they need to meet their needs. They're welcome to join in on your cardio classes, but if they want to learn how to defend themselves, perhaps they need to look somewhere else. And that's an integrity question. But where possible, we need to customize what we do to meet the needs of the different populations. And the benefit of this, right, I know there's some instructors out there right now that are saying, what a massive pain in the ass that will be. I've got 50 students every night, and they all have different experiences and different risks and so on. Sure, you can generalize a bit, but the better you get at customizing, the more demographics you can market to, right? The more business opportunities present. So don't rule that out. The fourth principle is inclusiveness. So risk management should be inclusive. It should include people in the process. So for me as an instructor, I always, always try to make an effort to remind myself to include people in the class to structure the content. What do you want? What are you worried about? What experiences have you had? What specific situations can I help you with? Do you want more theory, or do you want more practical? And being able to evolve around that. I mean, obviously you can't do it on class by class basis, because you might have 15 people in the room that all want different things. But involve your clients in the design process. Okay, if you're teaching weekly classes or multiple days a week, then do feedback surveys and find out what people are enjoying and what they want to see more of. Or encourage people to come to you with suggestions or things they particularly want to cover, because it's a cause of concern for them. But that inclusiveness is a crucial part of risk management. The next principle is dynamic. Right? So in risk management speak, dynamic means that you're able to pivot, you're able to adapt, you're able to adjust what you're doing to suit a new or emerging risk, or a risk that has suddenly become much larger or more significant than it was previously. So it's an element of agility. For what we do, I think very much the same. We need to be able to adapt to changing situations. If you have a different kind of crime wave that's creeping into your organization, into your community, where let's say the rise of acid attacks was a massive thing in the UK. That kind of came out of the blue. I mean, surely it was a groundswell. Okay, but for a lot of people, they were blindsided by it, because like, what the hell do you do with someone who's going to squirt acid at you? So being able to adapt to those trends, and not just the ones on TikTok to get you followers, but being able to adapt to trends of violence and crime and how people are being victimized and the situations that they're exposing themselves to and the different risk factors in society will make for a more robust violence prevention and management practice. The next principle of risk management is best available information. And that is a very loaded phrase, right? It means that organizations are expected to always access the best available information to help them make decisions, because really risk management is just the practice of making good decisions. So what are our best available information? Okay, what is our best available information? And can we take the blinders off just for a second to think that maybe the best available information doesn't come from within our dojo or within our organization? I've had conversations with well-meaning school owners, and when I suggest, hey, you should reach out and get this person to come in and do a webinar or do a workshop for you, or perhaps you should educate yourself a little bit further by attending this particular course. And I've been told, we can't do that. Our school or our system or our organization already does that. My sensei already did a course in psychology, and he teaches us all about it. Well, that's cool, but maybe your sensei's understanding of that one psychology course he did isn't sufficient for the needs of your students. So again, removing ourselves from that martial arts bubble and being able to look outside and go, what is the best available information on this particular challenge that I'm facing or that my students are facing? And talking to other professionals, social workers, psychologists, anthropologists, criminologists, whoever else it is that I need to consult with, to better make sure I have the best available information when it comes to building my curriculum and keeping my participants, my students, my clients safe. The next one is human and cultural factors. So good risk management always incorporates human and cultural factors. We've talked about this a bit already as I've been going through these, but understand your students, understand the human factors, understand the culture that your students are bringing, but also the culture of the environment in which they're living. If you've got a student who is traveling around the world doing aid work for all sorts of different cultures, then you're going to have to understand the cultures of where they're going to be able to help them appropriately. Similarly, you might be training a migrant or community. Okay? So if you've got people from a migrant community, understand their cultures, understand some of the human factors that go into why they perceive the world the way they do and how that maybe creates conflict situations or areas of risk within the environment they're living in. Understanding all of that and factoring that into your training and making sure you are not trying to cram everyone into a one-size-fits-all box goes a long, long way to making you a better, more effective instructor. My good friend and former guest Mary Stevens says that for her, one of the big turnoffs for any self-defense course is if it's buy bouncers for bouncers. And here I am as a former bouncer saying, don't do that. Don't just assume that just because you're a 30-something alpha male that everyone needs to be trained like a 30-something alpha male. In fact, most 30-something alpha males would benefit more from a lesson on empathy than they will from hitting hard, right? But don't assume everyone's after that. Human and cultural factors are huge. And not only will they make you a better instructor, they also make your business better as well, because people are going to feel heard, they're going to feel listened to, they're going to feel like they're actually getting value from what you're saying. So don't ignore that. And the last principle is continual improvement. So it's a foundational aspect of good risk management is continual improvement. Always identify opportunities to get better. Evaluate what you're doing. See whether it's working. Follow up with your students. Did that resonate with you? Do you remember anything that we covered last month? What are some of the things that stood out for you? Has anyone applied any of this stuff? Has anyone been able to think of a situation where this would have really helped them or someone they care about? Or did you share it with someone? Like, really get into the weeds and get some feedback on how well what you're doing is working. Now, hopefully, we don't have a whole lot of data of our students going out, getting into fights and getting mugged to get real, real empirical evidence. But we need to at least get their perspectives on how things are working, how they're finding it. And you need to continually be building upon your own skill sets as well. Identify where you are weak and keep working on those areas. Identify causes of concern or things that you think are coming and get better at those things. This is something that I try to do on a regular basis is just continually brainstorm, okay, what are some of the things on the horizon? So for me, an example that comes to mind very recently was with the when the COVID pandemic started really ramping up and borders started closing and there was restrictions in place. And by the way, the situation in Australia is not nearly as extreme as it was reported in the media. We don't need to be liberated. Please stand down. No invasion necessary. But it's certainly a lot of people were hurting financially. There was a lot of businesses that couldn't operate. There was a lot of stress. And one of the things that I realized was that, hey, those skill sets I have about home security and how to be a harder target and how to protect my property, I probably need to brush up on those because we're going to start seeing a lot more people out there that are desperate and a lot more people that are going to resort to petty crime. And so it's just a matter of me being aware of what was probably coming and just putting a couple of hours a month into just brushing up on some of those skills and just updating them a little bit. Now, for you, you might look at your skills and go, I'm really happy with my physical skills, but I actually have no idea how to teach communication. I might know roughly what to do, but I don't know how to teach it. I don't know how to structure it. Well, reach out to someone who does, people like me, people like Ellis Amder, people that can come in and talk to you and say, okay, here's how you build a curriculum around this. Those are things we can do. Oh, I don't know anything about the legal system in my country. Okay, well, make sure you get someone from your country or at least who has an understanding of your country. But reach out to someone like a Duncan Andrews who you had on the podcast who does scenario training up to and including going to court. Right? Those sorts of people are out there. Lean on them. Build your system with the best available information, but continually try to improve it. Challenge yourself to remove something that's not working and add something that is working every single time you review. It can only help you get better. And by the way, this is something that I now have a number of coaching clients, so listeners of the podcast that are reaching out to me to get one-on-one coaching to make them better coaches or to help them with their development of product offerings or to be able to expand upon what they're doing. And one of my coaching clients I challenged him to take his 1 day course and strip it back to a 4 hour course, and it nearly killed him. Right, it was incredibly painful for him to strip back a whole day to 4 hours. And then I asked him to strip it down to 2 hours, and like it was like I'd asked him to murder his favorite puppy. Right? And then after that, I said, okay, now here's your next challenge: strip it to 20 minutes. Have a look at what you have left in your 2 hour course that was originally a 1 day course, and figure out what is the most essential 20 minutes of that. And that is painful, and it sucks, because we all know that we can achieve more in a 4 hour course or a 1 day course than what we can in a 20 minute course. But if you can identify what are the most powerful and important 20 minutes in any 1 day course, that gives you an idea of where your areas for improvement are, what your foundational material is, and how you would manage a situation where you only have a short time to intervene or to give someone some information and that you're never going to see them again. So that's another way that you can drive continuous improvement. So those are the risk management principles. So I guess to conclude the second chunk of this episode, building a violence prevention and management practice on risk management principles. We talked about it being integrated, structured and comprehensive, customized, inclusive, dynamic, built on best available information, involving human and cultural factors, and continually trying to improve it every single time. If we can do that, man, imagine how good your practice will be very, very quickly. And the final thing, so part three, I guess, of this podcast now is the third thing that I think that we can really do as an industry to be better, and that is starting to seek professional training and how to be a good educator, how to actually deliver training with impact and influence that is sticky, that people remember, that people leave feeling like, not only did I get a good workout, but I actually feel safer. I feel like I'm smarter. I feel like I could teach my kids that. Or I feel like I need to go call my sister and tell her what I just learned, because that is so important. You do that through being a good educator, not just a good practitioner. Now, a lot of people are on this path, and I don't think it's foreign to a lot of people. I mean, if I think about my time in the combat sports, there's a lot of really great athletes that are kind of piss poor educators, to be brutally honest, right? They never learned how to coach. They're naturally gifted, so therefore they don't really understand what it's like to be someone who's uncoordinated or someone who doesn't have the ability to just make their leg do that thing that your leg does, because they haven't had to think about it. It just happens because they have really good neural connections, or you've got good fast twitch muscle fibers, and therefore they don't really understand how a regular person struggles with something. Those that really seek out a career in coaching, and certainly there are people that are naturally gifted as coaches as well, by all means. But those athletes that are not natural coaches that seek out a career in coaching, what do? They go and educate themselves. They go do formal education in how to coach, how to learn, how to teach. They apprentice under an experienced coach. And they're not just apprenticing in how to do their sport. They're apprenticing in how to teach their sport and how to manage human beings. That is what is missing for a lot of instructors. And that's largely because we don't have a lot of people in the world doing this stuff. Larger organizations will have black belt mentoring programs and so on, which are useful from a martial arts perspective, but they're not necessarily useful for violence prevention and management. So I am in the process of trying to build up a network of mentors that we can all lean upon for those of us that are on this path. And that is something that I'm going to talk about in just a little bit. But look, in terms of being a professional educator, some of the basics that I think we should be looking at, and this does differ a little bit depending on your medium of education. So I've been a regular class instructor, so teaching in a school or in a dojo, teaching a weekly or multiple times a week class, where you're seeing the same students give or take a couple of days a week. That is different. You need to make sure you have good curriculum design for that. But I've also been, and the way I teach mostly now is training people that I'm probably never going to see again, or I might see them once a year or once every 2 years when they come through my course. So I have either a day or half a day, or sometimes just an hour. Sometimes I literally have 10 minutes to talk to a group of people that I'm never going to see again. And I have to give them something that they're going to leave that session going, I'll remember that. That was good. So there's different skill sets involved in maintaining someone's ongoing development versus giving them something that is going to stick with them, is they're going to ponder and they're going to explore for themselves moving forward, because they're not going to have that ongoing training. So different skill sets there. But certainly from a professional educator's point of view, if you are running classes, you need to make sure you know how to do lesson plans. You need to make sure you got lesson plans that map to a long-term strategic outcome. You've got a curriculum that is weighted appropriately so that you are actually spending the time on the things that are the most important for your students. You need to make sure you have some sort of evaluation process in place so you can tell whether you're actually hitting the mark or not. How are you testing people? Are they getting better? Are they not getting better? And guess what? If they're not getting better, that's on you, right? That's the variable you can control, is how you teach that person. Maybe you need to sit down and have a chat to them and say, hey, what's going on in your life? Because, you know, you seem to be a little bit, you know, disconnected. And yeah, maybe that is the intervention that's required. But you have to be able to measure what you're doing to see whether it's working. That is all part of being a good instructor. And then you've got technical skills that a lot of people just haven't been taught. So how to communicate, how to lead, how to manage conflict situations within your cohorts, within your classroom, or within your club. How to manage interpersonal conflicts when they appear. Technical skills like how to run scenario training that actually makes people better rather than just stressed and scared. How to do role plays that are not painfully cringy and actually have training outcomes. Those things are important skills to develop. And if you don't know how to do it, then try to find books, trying to find mentors, trying to find courses, try to find things that help you get better, because we need to be professional educators. And then a lot of those will apply as well to the seminar presenter or to the education-based presenter, as I saw Randy King call it, which I think is kind of cool. But for those short, sharp interventions, it's how do you maintain someone's attention when they're often there under sufferance? A lot of the time I'm training people that if they were given the choice, would not be in the class, but they've been told they have to be because it's mandated by their work. So how do I train those people? I have to be likable. I have to be funny. I have to be entertaining. I have to have all those things so that they go, this isn't so bad, I'll listen to him. Because I might have them for a whole day. Right? And that whole day can be brutal. If you're an operational worker and you have to go sit in a classroom and listen to a workshop for 8 hours, that can be brutal. So I need to make sure that is as unpainful as possible, and I need to use stories that are relevant to them. I need to do my research. I need to try to make sure that everything that I am saying rings a bell for them as something they can relate to, because the second they can switch off, I lose them. So I have to make sure that I've covered those bases. That's part of being a good seminar instructor. I need to make sure I'm clear on my outcomes. It's not just about entertaining. I need to know what I need them to learn, what I need them to understand by the time they leave. So that is all part of being a good education-based or seminar-based instructor as well. So that's just touching the surface on some of the things that I think we need to work on as educators. So if I can circle back now and just sort of recap the three things we've talked about so far, and then I'm going to introduce something that we're doing to try and help people along this journey. So we talked about, firstly, let's redefine what we're doing. Scrap self-defense. This is not martial arts anymore. This is not physical response anymore. The physical response and some martial arts techniques may form part of our practice, but the practice is violence prevention and management. That's it. No other boundaries. Okay. Yes, there'll be elements of psychology. Yes, there may be parts of criminology. Yes, there may be parts of sociology. Yes, there might be parts of hoplology. Right? Yes, there might be parts of security. Yes, there might be parts of protection. Yes, there might be parts of martial arts. Yes, there might be parts of firearms. Okay, there's all sorts of things that may make up a solid violence prevention and management framework for you with your clientele in your environment. Okay, but let's get rid of the baggage of assuming we have to fit within a box that was never meant to contain this subject matter. Let's make sure that we are building from the ground up something that is perfectly suited to the needs of our students, not something that looks like what my instructor taught me and I really like that instructor and I don't want to hurt their feelings, so I'm just going to keep doing it that way. Okay, so that's the first thing. Build a practice on violence prevention and management. Secondly, let's apply those risk management principles that are universally regarded as the best ways to manage risk. This is a risk, we are managing it. So integration, structured and comprehensive, customized, inclusive, dynamic, best available information, human and cultural factors, and continual improvement. Apply those principles to what you are doing. You will end up with a better practice. And lastly, seek out professional education to become professional educators, okay? Whether you're doing class training, whether you're doing seminar training. Those are my three tenets for, I think, where the future of this industry is or what the next evolution of this industry should look like. I want people in 5 years from now to Google, I want to find a violence prevention and management instructor. I don't want them to put in, I need a karate instructor. I love karate. No knock on karate. If people want to do karate because they love karate, I hope they search for karate. If people want to learn how to be safe from violence, I hope they search violence prevention and management. That's what I'm hoping we can do. So that's the framework. So if you're sitting there nodding along, and if you've listened to 55 odd minutes or however long we are by the time I edit this, if you've listened all the way through this so far, and you haven't switched off after you realize that I didn't have a guest on, then I'm going to guess that you probably agree with at least some of what I've said, and it rings a bell for you. So what I'm starting this year, and this is something that has been developed, the first trial run will happen in the UK. And what it is a Managing Violence Certified Instructor Program. So it is a way for me to vouch for instructors wherever they are around the globe as someone that I can trust to be able to deliver on the things that we talk about on this podcast. And the reason this came about was that over the last 3 years, I've had a lot of people reach out to me from all over the world, probably something like 16 different countries now, where people have reached out to me and said, hey, thanks for the podcast. Really love listening to it. Do you know someone close to me who does what you do or does what you talk about? And a lot of the time, like on a handful of occasions, they have lived close by to someone that I can really vouch for, that I know gets it. But a lot of the time, they don't. They live close to someone who I know through one form or another, like, oh, this person is an excellent MMA coach, and they're probably going to be able to give you some good physical skills, but I don't know about the other stuff. I don't know if they know how to talk. I don't know if they know situational awareness, right? I don't know any of that stuff because that's not what I know them for. This is a really good Krav Maga gym, but you know, Krav Maga is different wherever you go, and like they may not be very good at de-escalation because that's not something that's always available. So there was a lot of yes but recommendations that I was giving out, and I thought, man, wouldn't it be good if I just had people that I could tell listeners, hey, if you're in this area, absolutely go see this gym. They do really good stuff. This instructor is really good. And as someone that I can personally vouch for. So that was kind of the germ of the idea. It was like, how do I just build up a bit of a database of instructors that listeners and fans of the show can click on a link and they can go to a page and they can find a global map of instructors that are quality. The challenge I had with that is I have railed against instructor certifications in the martial arts for a long time because I think especially short form instructor qualifications where someone comes off the street and 3 days later they're an instructor and they're supposed to know how to teach, like that's absolutely ludicrous. But what we've decided to do is to build something to facilitate continual professional education for existing instructors. So assuming you already have skill sets, okay, whether it's physical, whether it's emotional, whether it's psychological, whatever, you have skill sets, you're actively teaching, we will help you bridge those gaps. We will help you fill the gaps that may exist within your own understanding, whether they're self-diagnosed or whether they're things that come to our attention. There is an assessment process to get in. There's a training requirement to get in. But once you're in there, it's really just about helping you become a better instructor. So this is not a zero to hero weekend certification. It's designed to be a gap filler and a quality assurance program so that the Managing Violence podcast, the brand that goes with that, whatever credibility I have can be invested into those instructors as a quality assurance measure. It's not style specific. We are not doing, there's no Managing Violence approved stance, right? There's no Managing Violence approved escape to a throat grab. It's professional development. It is not a martial arts system. There's not going to be any belts. There's not going to be any grades. We're not giving you discounts on insurance. We're not going to help you get leases on premises. It's none of this. This is not an organization thing that you have to join and you know, keep paying over and over and over to be able to stay a member. That's not how this works. It's also not a cash for certificate transaction. So I'm not going to be taking money and grading everybody or accrediting everybody. You pay for the education. If you pass the assessment and you pass the criteria that we set, then you get to be a Managing Violence Certified Instructor, okay? Which you can then use for marketing, and we can assist with being able to push that forward. So some of the things that we'll be talking about in terms of the education, fundamentals of leadership and influence is a big one. How do you lead? How do you influence people? How do you communicate with influence? We'll give you crash courses in the psychology of violence, both social and predatory. We'll cover curriculum design for holistic violence education, all those things that I talked about just before. Working with vulnerable populations, so not just for bouncers by bouncers, but how do we work with aged persons? How do we work with survivors of domestic abuse? How do we work with children that have been incarcerated? How do you work with those different populations to achieve outcomes? We'll talk about planning, designing, and delivering scenario-based training. So we all recognize that scenario-based training is a great training tool, but there's probably more people in the world doing it badly than doing it well. So how do we bridge those gaps? How do we apply some science behind that scenario-based training to make sure we are doing it in a way that makes our students better and safer as opposed to just tired? And we'll also talk about psychological first aid and some of those other pieces. Now, as part of, that's just the initial training, then ongoing after that, we will be delivering quarterly webinars as well to continue to bridge gaps, to continue to provide fill-in information either by myself or by people in the Managing Violence Network. Different subject matter expertise, maybe some quarter will be business practices to help you expand your offerings, expanding into new markets, all sorts of things. As mentioned before, like collaboration and inclusivity is important, so we'll be taking feedback from participants as to what they want to learn. You will be included on the global database of Managing Violence Certified Instructors, and you will get referrals from the Managing Violence podcast. And further, anyone who passes and becomes a certified instructor will also get a 5 to 10 minute mini interview on the podcast as an introduction to it for anyone who may be in your area. So there are some prerequisites. All that information is available. There is a cost involved, obviously, to do this, but it is pretty much cost neutral. So I've decided that I don't want this to be a massive financial thing that is either prohibitive for people that that don't have the money, or alternatively, I don't want to ever be compromised because I really would like to certify more people because it pays really well. So it's pretty much going to be cost neutral for me in that it covers costs and we get to do some good in the world and improve the standards of the industry. So look, the initial program for this is going to be happening. I've got two courses booked in Oxford and Cambridge in the UK. The Oxford one is running 26th to 28th of March, and then the Cambridge one is running 9th through 11th of April. But then we'll also be taking an online cohort after that. So details will still come out if you're interested in that moving forward. So, folks, look, this whole episode was not a plug for that program. I really wanted to plant a flag. I wanted to say, okay, we've done 100 episodes. I've spent a lot of time under the learning tree now of the industry's best leading experts. It's been an incredible apprenticeship, and it's time that we use that information to start making people safer. And the only way we do that is to fix some of the issues that are currently in our industry. We rally together people that are on the same page. Anyone who doesn't want to come with us, that's fine. That is totally fine. If you just want to teach boxing and MMA, and you want to do your your traditional martial arts or time capsule arts, I love that phrase, Randy King. Thank you very much. You want to teach martial arts because you love martial arts, then man, I am so for that. But if you want to teach violence prevention and management, let's teach violence prevention and management. Let's build this thing so that it's fit for purpose, so that the next generation has the option of choosing that rather than sifting through the thousands of options on Google trying to figure out which ones are going to be the ones that are going to help them stay safe. So that is episode 100. I know it's really unconventional. It flies in the face of what we've done in the past, but I can't think of a better use for this episode than to plant a flag and say, this is where we're going next, guys. So if you're on board, I look forward to having you with me. If you're not on board, you just want to listen to me and listen to guests, cool, keep doing that too. I thank you guys so much for your support. 100 episodes, 150 hours, 3 years of the most incredible conversations, and we are quite proudly 100 not out. We are still going ahead. Next week, we'll be back with episode 101. I'm going to be joined by Kerry Murakami talking about law enforcement defensive tactics. Until then, I'll talk to you next time.